and don't think they couldn't patch in even to this call. They're watching my car. They think I'm eating. Good time to slip away? Too open. I've got to get them to somewhere more densely populated, maybe Denver. Be careful. Thanks for nothing. Hattie, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that, Buck. I was trying to be funny. Nothing's funny anymore, is it? If you shake them and are sure, try me again. We may not be at the same place, but if we can accommodate you, you would, wouldn't you? Of course we would. You know us. Yes, I do. You all were better than I deserved. I'd better get off. Yeah. I suppose you've heard they're trying to pin the assassination on Rayford. I heard. Has to be a frame-up. He probably wasn't even there. He was there, but he didn't do it. You don't have to convince me. Rayford kill somebody? Not in a million years. I know him better than that. Listen, just tell everybody I'm safe, and so are they, and thanks for everything I didn't deserve. Hattie, we all love you and are praying for you. I know you are, Buck.
David, stunned at the difference between Dr. Eikenberry's public announcements and the autopsy, frantically searched his database for a meeting between her and Fortunato prior to the meeting with management. He had to know what approach Leon had used in case Leon tried the same with him. Via his hard drive, he bounced all over the compound but had no luck. He did, however, come upon a private meeting between Leon and an unidentified male in a conference room near Carpathia's office. "And how long have you been working for us, sir?"
"Almost from the very beginning, Mr. Fort Supreme Commander."
"And you're from?"
"Greenland."
"You enjoy your work?"
"Until the assassination, yes."
"The shooting?"
"Well, I meant the stabbing. The assassination of those two guys at the Temple Mount, that was exciting. I mean, to see His Excellency put them in their place.
But you didn't enjoy your job so much when you saw the potentate himself murdered."
"No, sir. I kept the camera right on him, but it was the hardest thing I've ever done."
"You know the autopsy is finished, and it was the gunshot that killed the potentate."
David could not decipher the response, but it sounded like a snort.
"But there was only one gunshot, Commander."
"There was only one needed, son.
It was a weapon identical to the one His Excellency used on the troublemakers at the Wailing Wall."
"I understand that, but from where I sat above stage left, I saw the wood speakers thing."
"The lectern."
"Yeah, that. I saw that get hit and the curtain go flying."
"No way that bullet also hit the potentate. He was closer to me." "Nevertheless, it has been determined that..."
"Excuse me, Commander, but the real murder happened right below me, and I saw it happen."
"And you have reviewed this?"
"Watched it over and over. Couldn't believe it."
"And you discussed it with whom?"
"Just my boss."
"That would be Mr. Bakar?"
"Yes, sir."
Footsteps, a door opening. More faintly,
"Margaret, would you have Mr. Bakar join us, please? Thank you."
The door shut, and David heard Leon's chair.
"Look into my eyes, son."
"There, yes. You trust me, do you not?"
"Of course."
"When your superior gets here, I am going to tell you both what you saw and what you will remember."
"Excuse me?"
"I am going to tell you what you saw and what you will remember."
"But, sir, I know what I..."
"You understand that I will soon become the new potentate, don't you?"
"I assume that, yes, sir."
"You did?"
"I think most people assume that."
"Do they?" No response.
"Do they?" Leon repeated.
"Don't just nod. Tell me."
The young man's voice sounded hollow.
"Yes." "You understand that my new title will be Supreme Potentate, and that I must also be addressed as Excellency?"
"Yes, Commander."
"You may try out the new title now."
"Yes, Excellency."
and you realize that I will not only be worthy of worship, but also that worship of me will be mandatory.
Yes, Excellency.
Call me Potentate, Supreme Potentate.
Yes, Supreme Potentate.
Would you like to kneel before me? Silence. Then a knock and a loud sigh from Leon, the door opening.
Excuse me, Commander, but Mr. Bakar is currently engaged in...
Margaret! Leon hissed fiercely. Do not interrupt me again.
I'm sorry, sir.
I don't want apologies, and I don't want to hear that my subordinates have more important things to do. The next person through this door had better be Mr. Bakar, and for your sake, it had better be within 90 seconds.
Right away, sir.
The door, the chair. Now then, son, where were we?
I was worshipping you, Supreme Potentate.
Another chair. That's it. Yes, kneel before me and kiss my ring.
I see no ring, sir.
Kiss my finger where the ring will soon be. A quick knock and the door opening. Bakar's voice. Forgive me, Commander, I...
What the devil is going on?
Sit, Director.
What's he doing on the floor?
He was just about to tell me what was on the video disc you brought back from Jerusalem.
You've seen it, haven't you, Supreme Commander?
Of course, but it seems there's a discrepancy between what he and I saw and what you apparently saw.
Oh?
Yes, Fortunato said. Return to your chair and tell your boss what you saw.
I heard the gunshot and saw the Potentate's head snap back.
I get it, Bakar said. A joke. Now the gun killed him? We all know that's not true.
It's true, the cameraman said.
Yeah, I was born yesterday and went blind today.
Did you go blind, Bakar? Leon said soothingly. What?
Lean across the table here and let me see your eyes.
My eyes are fine, Commander.
Bakar, are you listening to me?
Of course, but...
Are you listening?
Yes.
Are you listening? Really listening?
Silence.
I have your attention now, don't I, Bakar?
You do, sir.
Bakar, you understand that I will soon become the new Potentate, don't you? David could stand to listen no more and clicked away from the feed. He stood, dizzy and sick to his stomach. He called Annie and apologized for waking her.
What is it, David? She said.
I need you, he said. Meet me soon, before I get called in to see Fortunato. Rayford and Leah agreed to meet Chloe in a mostly destroyed banquet hall that had been turned into a dimly lit, dingy bar. They were ignored, sitting in a dark corner, huddled against wind that gusted through huge gaps in the wall. Rayford and Chloe embraced, but he wasted little time chastising her. This is more dangerous than staying put, even if Hattie leads the GC right to the safe house. There's a chance they won't find the underground.
We need the new place, Dad, she said, and I'm tired of doing nothing.
Granted, but let's not get crazy. Leah's phone chirped.
This is, Jerry Seaver. Oh, I'm sorry. I...
Click.
Oh, no, Leah said. That was Ming, I'm sure of it.
Hit callback, Rayford said. Any doubts Buck had about Chaim's physical condition were erased when they finally left the night visitors. Chaim knew exactly where they were headed. He had ripped from one clean corner of his blanket a piece large enough to fit under his hat and extend down the back of his neck and both sides of his face. His nondescript shirt and blousy pants made him look like any other Israeli day laborer, and he had replaced his slippers with boots. Buck had a tough time keeping up with him. He jogged as Chaim walked quickly, and though the man was a foot shorter and more than 30 years older, he wore Buck out. We get to America, and what, I'm holed up with Zion and you? I won't need to kill myself. You'll both talk me to death.
There's nothing we could say that you haven't heard already, Buck said, gasping and grateful that that comment had made Chaim stop briefly.
Now there's the truest thing I've heard all day.
That's not so, Buck said, slow to start moving again when Chaim took off.
What?
Chaim said, a step and a half ahead. The truest thing you heard today was that you are lost. Again, Chaim stopped and turned.
I'm lost?
Yes. In the dim light in the middle of the ravaged city of God, Buck saw the pain in his friend's face.
You don't think I know I'm lost? Chaim said incredulously. If there's one thing I do know, one thing I am certain of, it is that I am lost. Why do you think I would sacrifice myself to murder the greatest enemy my country has ever had? I did not expect to survive. I was ready to go. Why? Because I am lost, nothing to live for, nothing. My farewell act was to be some benefit to Israel. Now the deed is done and I am here, and yes, I am lost.
Buck was desperate that Chaim not give them away with his ranting, but that was only one reason he approached his dear friend, arms outstretched, and embraced him.
You don't need to be lost, Chaim. You don't need to be.
And the old man sobbed in Buck's arms. Chapter 11.
Don't hang up, it's Leah.
She had moved out to the Land Rover to make the call.
It sounded like you,
came the voice Leah never felt fit the delicate Ming toy.
But who is Jerry something?
We international fugitives have to keep changing identities, Ming. If it weren't for the intrigue, what would be the appeal?
I don't know how you keep your sense of humor. This is too dangerous, too frightening for me.
You handle it well, Ming.
I called with a question. Your friend Williams?
Buck, yes.
No, not Buck. Longer name.
Cameron?
Yes. Where's his family?
West somewhere. Why? I think only his father and brother are still around.
I don't think they're around either.
There was lots of talk at Buffer today about what happened to Dr. Rosenzweig's house and his people. They don't know where he is, but they're making it look like everybody died in the fire.
Yes?
They're saying the same thing will happen to Cameron Williams's people if they don't give him up.
His relatives don't know where he is, Leah said. He's smarter than to give them that kind of information.
Leah, they may already be dead. This was supposed to happen right away.
What was?
Torture, dismemberment.
They tell or they are killed.
Then comes the fire to cover it up.
I don't know what to do. Just have your friend check on them. Maybe he can warn them in time.
I will, Ming.
How are you doing?
Ready to come see us?
Whoops, hang on.
Leah slid down in the seat as two uniformed GC officers strolled by. They stopped right next to the Rover, chatting and smoking.
Ming, Leah whispered, can you still hear me?
Barely. What's going on?
I've got company. If I don't say anything, you'll know why.
If you need to hang up, I'd rather stay on with you.
Let me give you Rayford Steele's number in case I get caught. He'll answer to Marvin Berry.
Got it.
Leah felt the vehicle rock.
They're leaning against the car, she said. Luckily, all the windows are tinted except the windshield.
Where are you?
Illinois. I mean in the car.
Floor of the front seat.
Wish I were daintier. The gear shift is killing me.
They don't see you?
Don't think so. I can hear them plain as day.
What?
Leah didn't want to speak louder.
The peacekeepers were trading wild party stories. She wanted to say, "Yeah, and I'm the Easter Bunny," but she lay still.
"This hunk of junk looks like it's been through a war," one said. "It has, stupid. It's old enough to have been through the war and the earthquake. Tough make. Not as tough as the Land Cruiser. No? Same company? Toyota. Really? Expensive. More than this? Quite a bit more. No kidding. This thing's loaded. I think it's got a GPS. This rig? Nah. Betcha. How much? 10 spot. You're on."
"Oh, no," Leah whispered. "They're coming to the front. You need me to call Rayford?" But Leah didn't answer. She tucked the phone between the seats and pretended to sleep.
"See, isn't that the positioning system right there? Hey, she all right?" "Who?" "Oh, man, door's unlocked. Ask her."
A rap on the window.
"Hey, lady."
Leah ignored it, but moved slightly so they wouldn't think she was dead. When one opened the passenger door, she sat up trying to look groggy.
"Hey, what's the deal?" she said. "You want me to call a peacekeeper?"
"We are peacekeepers, ma'am."
"There a law against a girl getting some shut-eye?"
"No, but what are you doing on the floor, back seats wide open?"
"Trying to stay out of the sun."
She sat up in the seat, desperate to remember her new address and hometown. Zeke Jr. had reminded her more than once to memorize it as soon as possible. She hated being so new at this part of the game.
"This your vehicle?"
"Borrowing it."
"From?"
"Guy named Russell."
"That a first or last name?"
"Russell Staub."
"He know you're borrowing it?"
"Course. What are you driving at?"
"Run a check on it," one told the other, who immediately got on his phone. "Where's he from, ma'am?"
"Mount Prospect."
"What are you doing all the way down here?"
She shrugged.
"Supposed to meet some friends."
"We're gonna find this Rover registered to a Staub in Mount Prospect, right?"
She nodded.
"I don't do his paperwork for him, but that's whose it is, and that's where it's from."
"You got any ID, ma'am?"
"Yeah, why?"
"I'd like to see it."
You've come a long way from wondering if I was all right to accusing me of stealing a car.
"I didn't accuse you of anything, lady. You feeling guilty about something?"
"Should I be?"
"Let me see your ID."
Leah made a show of digging through her purse even after she had located the new documents so she could take a last peek at the new information.
"This your current address, Miss Seaver?"
"If it says Park Ridge, it is."
"You're a long way from home, too."
"Only because there are hardly any roads anymore."
"That's the truth." "Staub, Mount Prospect," the other officer said. "No outstandings and no reports."
Leah raised her eyebrows, her pulse racing.
"Satisfied?"
He handed back her ID.
"Don't be out and about without something to do, ma'am. Why don't you get this vehicle back to the owner and get on home?"
"Can't I get a drink first, in case my friends show up?"
"Don't be long."
"Thank you."
She pushed open the car door and saw Rayford and Chloe on their way out, concern on their faces.
"Oh, there they are now. Thanks again, officers."
Annie had hurried to David's office. They pretended it was a normal superior-subordinate meeting, and he quickly told her what he had heard. She paled.
"That sounds like what Buck Williams went through with Carpathia at the UN.
But who knew Fortunato could do that?"
"Is he the Antichrist?"
Annie said. David shook his head. "I still think it's Carpathia."
"But he's really dead, David. I mean, really. How long was he in that bag and in that box? I thought he was supposed to come back to life right away."
"Dr. Ben-Judah thought so, too," he said. "What do we know? If we had this stuff figured out, we probably would have figured out the rest and wouldn't have been left behind."
David's secretary buzzed him.
"The Supreme Commander would like to see you."
Annie grabbed his hands.
"God," she whispered. protect him on every side.
Amen, David said.
Buck and Chaim sat shivering in a ditch at the far north end of a deserted and blocked-off road. Only a small stretch remained smooth, and Buck began to wonder whether it was long enough for the Super J. The jet might be able to land and take off without attracting attention, but if T had to circle or take more than one shot at it, who knew? Worse, the stretch was unlit. T would use his landing lights only as much as he had to, counting on Buck to guide him in by phone. That meant Buck would have to stand at one end of the makeshift runway or the other. He opted for the front end so he could talk T through coming straight over his head, then he could spin and try to keep him straight until he landed. The only danger was T's coming in too low, too quickly. Buck would have to leap out of the way. Still, that seemed easier than trying to elude a plane careening toward him at the other end. "This is a lot of trouble for someone who doesn't want to leave," Chaim said. "Well, I want to leave, even if you don't." Buck's phone rang, and he assumed it was T, though he hadn't heard the plane yet. It was Rayford. "We have a situation here," Rayford said, quickly bringing him up to date on Hattie. "The question is whether now is the time to talk." "It's not," Buck said. "But in a nutshell, what's up?" "Wouldn't do that to you, Buck. Call us when you're in the air or in Greece, and greet the brothers for us." "Will do," Buck said, puzzled at Rayford's new tone. It was as if he were talking to his old father-in-law. "Chloe sends her love and wants to talk with you when you have time." "Thanks, me too."
"I love you, Buck."
"Thanks, Ray. I love you, too." David realized how petrified he was when he nearly blundered by heading straight toward the conference room upon reaching the 18th floor. "He in there?" he said, trying to mask his anxiety. "No," Margaret said, clearly puzzled. "He's with Messrs. Hickman and Moon in his office. They're expecting you." "I will not kneel," David vowed. "I will not worship or kiss his hand. Lord, protect me." Leon and the other two directors huddled around a TV monitor. Leon still appeared grief-stricken. "Once we get His Excellency into the tomb," he said, his voice thick with emotion, "the world can begin approaching some closure. Prosecuting his murderer can only aid in achieving that. Watch this with us, David. Tell me if you see what we see." David approached the monitor, certain Fortunato could hear his heartbeat and see the flush of his face. He nearly missed the chair, then settled in awkwardly. Shot from above, the video disc was crystal clear. At the sound of the gunshot from Carpathia's left, he had turned and run into the wheelchair as Chaim rolled toward him. Chaim grabbed at the metal back support over his left shoulder and quickly produced what appeared to be a 2-foot sword. As Nikolai tumbled atop him, Chaim whipped the weapon in front of him, holding it with both hands, point up, sharp edge facing away from the potentate. Chaim lifted his forearms as Carpathia's body met the blade, and the sword slipped into his neck and straight through the top of his head as easily as a bayonet would slice a watermelon. Carpathia's hand shot to his chin, but David kept his eyes on Chaim, who violently twisted the handle at the base of Nikolai's neck. He let go as Carpathia dropped, then quickly steered stage left and sat with his back to the dying man.
"Well," Leon said, peering at him, "is there any doubt?"
David stalled, but all that served was to make the other two glance at him.
"Cameras don't lie," Leon said. "We have our assassin, don't we?"
Much as he wanted to argue, to come up with some other way to interpret what was clear, David would jeopardize his position if he proved illogical. He nodded.
"We sure do."
Leon approached him, and David froze. The Supreme Commander took David's face in his fleshy hands and looked deep into his eyes. David fought the urge to look away, praying all the while that he would do the right thing, and hoping that Annie was continuing to pray too. Like Nikolai, here was a man with clear mind control over unbelievers. He felt his pulse in his ears and wondered if Leon could detect his panic through his fingers.
"Director Hasid," Leon said, eyes boring into his. "Rayford Steele shot our beloved potentate."
Rayford? Hadn't they watched the same video?
Leon would be suspicious if David agreed too quickly.
"No," David said. "The disc was clear. Dr. Rowe, a stroke victim and a great loyal statesman, would be incapable of such an act, would he not?"
"But..." Fortunato's sweaty palm still cupped his cheeks. "The only killing weapon was the saber in the hands of Rayford Steele, who shall have to pay for his crime."
"Rayford Steele?" David said, his voice cracking like a junior high schooler.
"The assassin."
"The assassin?"
"Look again, David, and tell me what you see."
David was terrified. He hadn't noticed anyone switching discs, yet this version indeed showed Rayford firing at the stage. David wondered if he was weaker than Buck had been 3.5 years before. Was it possible that Leon could make him see something that wasn't there? He stared unblinking. Time seemed to stand still. Someone had to have changed the disc while he was distracted in Leon's hands. This was no concoction, no mind game, for while this showed the gunshot, it also showed Nikolai falling into Chaim's lap. "Slow it down," David said, trying to mimic the flat voices he had heard earlier. He believed his ruse was failing miserably, but he had no choice but to play it out.
"Yes, Walter," Leon said. "Show the fatal shot again and slow it down."
David fought for control, determined to watch the lectern, the curtain, the kings. As soon as the flash of fire and the puff of smoke appeared at the end of the saber, the lectern split and the pieces hurtled toward the 10 kings. The curtain seemed to twist on itself from the middle and shoot into the distance. Chaim appeared to come from behind the falling potentate and steer toward the center of the stage. The angle was wrong for seeing what he had actually done. To his disgust, David had to submit a second time to Leon's hands on his face.
"Well," Leon said, peering at him, "is there any doubt?"
This time, David could not stall. He was suddenly aware of Leon's overbearing cologne. How had he missed that before?
"Cameras don't lie," Leon said. "We have our assassin, don't we?"
David nodded, forcing Leon to loosen his grip.
"We sure do," he managed. "Steele must pay."
"I hate this," Leah said as the three sat inside again. "It's nerve-wracking. We shouldn't be out during the day. Too many things can go wrong."
"You shouldn't have gone to the car," Chloe said. Leah cocked her head and gave Chloe a stare.
"I shouldn't have gone to the car. I'm not the reason we're here, dear."
"I didn't ask you to come," Chloe said.
"Stop," Rayford said. "This gets us nowhere. Now, Chloe, I'm sorry, but this was a monumentally stupid thing to do."
"Dad, we need to get to the new place."
"And we have to check it out, but we're way past where we can get away with being out 1 second more than necessary, except at night."
"All right, okay. I'm sorry."
Leah reached for her hand.
"Me too," she said, but Chloe pulled away.
"Come on, don't do that," Leah said.
"I shouldn't have said that, and I'm sorry. We have to be able to work together."
"We need to get out of here," Rayford said. "Those guys think we're just friends in here for a drink. We can't stay till dark."
"We should get closer to Chicago," Chloe said.
That'll look more suspicious, Rayford said, unless we can find a place where we could leave the cars out of sight and still be able to walk into the city.
Where the L-tracks end now? Chloe suggested.
They end everywhere, Leah said. Totally shut down, right?
Well, Chloe said, the tracks are torn up heading in from the south, and then they're okay in the city, but they're closed.
Rayford looked to the ceiling. So how about we find a place to hide the cars down that way, coming in from separate directions, then follow the tracks into the city? Leah nodded.
Good idea, Chloe said.
That's what I thought.
If you're where I think you are, T said, it looks impossible.
You can see the road, Buck said.
Why can't I hear you?
Wind, maybe, but you'll hear me soon. I'm already lower than I want to be, but I sure hope I'm looking at the wrong road.
There's only one possibility in this area, Buck said. If you see any stretch of open road, you're looking at us.
Buck, do you have any idea how long it takes for one of these to stop? An aircraft carrier would be easier.
Any options?
Yeah, I land at Jerusalem Airport, or better yet, Tel Aviv, and we hope for the best.
It would be more efficient for Chaim to commit suicide right here than to risk that, T. They're looking for him.
I'm willing to try this, Buck, but it sure seems an uninspired way to become a martyr.
I hear you.
Thanks.
I mean, I literally hear you. Flash your landing lights.
I see you.
You're way to my right.
Adjusting.
More.
More, more. There.
No, a little left now. Hold.
I see nothing.
Use your lights when you need to. That'll help me, too.
I don't like what I'm not seeing.
The landing lights came on and stayed on this time.
Now I don't like what I am seeing.
You seem high. I thought you were too low.
I was lower than I wanted to be with all these emergency lights off to the left down there. Let's hope they're too busy to look up.
You still seem high.
I am, but I still don't see you either.
If you stay up there, I'm safe.
You're gonna go around again?
Negative. I have one shot and I'm gonna make it work.
You'd better start dropping.
Here I come.
Buck put his phone down and waved, though he couldn't imagine T seeing him from that angle. The plane drifted right, and Buck tried to signal T back to center. With his lights still on, T should have been able to see that for himself. As the Super J screamed past him, Buck grabbed his phone and shouted,
"You straight?"
"Straight as I can get. No way this works. Too steep, too fast.
Abort? Too late."
Buck shut his eyes as the plane dropped and the hot exhaust swept past him. He covered his ears, knowing that would never block the sound of the impact. But what he heard wasn't a plane crash. He thought he detected the screech of tires over the din of the jets, but that may have been wishful thinking. He peeked through the dust and exhaust to see the plane bounce a couple of feet, the red exhaust flame pointing at him. The next impact resounded like a rifle shot. White smoke billowed from beneath the craft, and the plane began spinning wildly, the red exhaust, then the landing lights, then the exhaust again. Suddenly the lights went off, but the jets continued to burn. The noise abated, except for the whine of the engine, but Buck no longer saw anything. The plane had to be facing him. He had not heard the fuselage break up, as he had feared if T couldn't stop. He ran toward the plane, amazed to see Chaim beside him, keeping pace. The New Babylon night was warm and dry. Spotlights from a dozen angles bathed the palace courtyard nearly bright as day. Nothing would compete with the merciless, cloudless, sun-filled daytime sky, but until then, everyone could clearly see all there was to see. David and Annie were among the hundreds of employees allowed, or in their case, assigned, to file past the bier ahead of the pilgrims from around the globe. The couple waited on the steps while 10 pallbearers, 4 men on each side and 1 at each end, solemnly carried in the draped plexiglass box accompanied by a live orchestra playing a dirge.
From behind the barricades, an eighth of a mile away, the mourning began. Employees began to wail, too. The men gently placed the bier atop the pedestal and carefully positioned it. A technician, with what appeared to be a portable vacuum cleaner tucked under one arm, knelt between one of the end men and a side man and screwed a pressure gauge into the rubber stopper at the foot end. He checked the readout twice, then hooked a hose to the stopper, twisted a dial, and ran the suction machine for 2 seconds. He checked the pressure once more, removed everything but the stopper, then hurried away. The 8 side men backed smartly away while the 2 on the ends removed the shroud. Annie seemed to recoil. David was stunned. He had expected Carpathia to appear lifelike. The work of Dr. Eikenberry had been astounding, of course, as there was no evidence of trauma. Yet somehow, even in a dark suit, white shirt, and striped tie, Carpathia appeared more lifeless than any corpse David had ever seen. The bier itself was shaped like an old-fashioned pine box, the torso area expanding to contain Carpathia's robust physique. The lid was 2 inches thick and bolted to the sides with huge stainless steel screws that bit deep into the plastic, pulled the casket gasket tight, and were secured at their undersides by self-locking washers and screws. The lid wasn't 3 inches above Carpathia's face, and as people passed, they could lean over the velvet ropes and see their breath on the top. If this was Carpathia, he would be closer to his people in death than he had ever been in life. David had listened to the revised autopsy report wherein all references to the sword and its damage were omitted and the bullet trauma was added. At the end of that, Dr. Eikenberry had launched a clinical play-by-play as she secured the eyelids with adhesive and stitched the lips with invisible thread. David was curious and wanted a closer look. Fortunately, the cluster in front of them paused for more than a minute. David leaned forward and studied the remains, knowing this probably made him look grief-stricken. He wondered if this was really Carpathia. The body looked stiff, cold, pale. Could it be a wax figure? Might the resurrection occur in the morgue refrigerator? The vacuum-sealed plexiglass bier certainly would not be conducive. Carpathia's hands were more lifelike and convincing. Left was draped over right at the waist, and they looked manicured and only slightly paler than in life. They rested within a 1/4 inch of the transparent lid. David almost wished the man were worthy of this display. David was stunned when several ahead of him made religious gestures, from crossing themselves to bowing. A woman nearly toppled as she gave in to tears, and David wondered what the outcry from the public would be like if GC personnel reacted like this. 3 armed guards stood on the other side of the bier. When any mourner touched the glass, the closest guard leaned over and wiped the prints away, polishing, polishing. Finally, the line moved, and David tried to guide Annie for a closer look. She surreptitiously stiffened, and he let her stay outside him as they passed. The man behind David collapsed to his knees upon full view of the body and moaned in a foreign tongue. David turned to see it was Bakar. Annie left, still looking exhausted, and David moved atop an observation deck that had been fashioned as the 2nd floor of one of the medical tents. He watched as the barricades were pulled away and the crowd slowly began to move toward the bier. Someone hurrying around the outside of the courtyard distracted David, heading toward where the evidence room had already been dismantled. It was a woman carrying a bulky paper package. He scampered down and excused himself through the crowd to get to the area from the opposite direction of the woman. When he arrived, he saw her, Dr. Eikenberry, hurrying back the way she had come. Guy Blod stood there with the package. He looked at David and shrugged. "We're going to make dawn," he said, "thanks to your help." David didn't want to be pals with Guy, but he did want to know what was in the package. "What have you got there, Minister Blod?" "Just something," she said, "the Supreme Commander wants in the statue." "In the statue?"
Gee nodded. Which means it has to go in now, because once we weld this together, the only things that will get inside it will have to be smaller than the eyeballs, nostrils, or mouth. I mean, at 4 times life size, they'll be plenty big, but... May I? David said, reaching for the package.
Whatever, Gee said. It's going to burn anyway.
Burn? Or melt? The hollow legs will be an eternal furnace. Don't you love it?
What's not to love? David said, peeking through a corner of the paper. In his hands was the real murder weapon.
Chapter 12. As Rayford followed Leah and Chloe out of the ersatz bar, one of the GC peacekeepers was coming in.
You wouldn't be Ken Ritz, would you?
Rayford fought for composure and noticed Leah stiffen and Chloe shoot the man a double take. With a furtive nudge, Rayford urged Chloe to keep moving and hoped Leah would do the same.
Who's asking? Rayford said.
Just yes or no, partner, the guard said.
Then no, Rayford said, brushing past.
Hold on a second there, Pop.
Rayford preferred partner.
Let me see some ID.
I told you I'm not whoever you're looking for.
The guard stood in the doorway with his hand out. Rayford showed his papers.
So, Mr. Berry, you know Ken Ritz?
Can't say that I do.
How about your friends?
Guess you'd have to ask them.
No need to be a smart aleck.
My apologies, but how would I know about them if I don't know him?
The guard nodded his dismissal, and as Rayford emerged, he heard him calling out in the bar,
Ken Ritz in here? R-I-T-Z.
Leah and Chloe waited by the Rover while the other guard had 1 foot on the bumper of the Suburban. He was on the phone. Rayford walked nonchalantly to the driver's side of the Rover and the three climbed in. As he pulled away, Rayford said,
Well, so much for the Suburban.
Thanks to me, Chloe said. Go ahead and say it, you two. This is all my fault. Chaim's bravado had finally cracked. Buck thought it might have been due to exhaustion from the running, but for whatever reason, the old man was in a panic. Buck was strangely encouraged. There was little more difficult than rescuing someone who didn't care to be rescued. At least Chaim retained a degree of self-preservation. It was a start. The Super J sat at a severe angle with a blown tire. The door swung down and T leaned out.
You must be Dr. Rosenzweig, he shouted.
Yeah, hey, hi, how are you? Chaim said with a wave.
You know we got people coming, and you've got a flat tire?
I was afraid of that, T said. He reached to shake Rosenzweig's hand.
Save the introductions until the GC shoots us, Chaim said. We've got to get out of here. Have you taken off in a plane with only one tire?
We're not going to outrun anybody on foot. Let's give this a try.
Buck stepped up behind Rosenzweig and tried to guide him up the stairs. He wouldn't be moved.
This is lunacy, Cameron. There's barely enough road here to take off if the plane was healthy.
You ready to turn yourself in?
No.
Well, we're leaving. You coming or taking your chances? Buck pushed past him up the steps. He grabbed the handle and set himself to lift the door.
Last call, he said. There's no chance on the plane, Rosenzweig whined. We're all going to die.
No, Chaim, Buck said. Our only chance is in the air. Have you given up? Rosenzweig leaped aboard as T muscled the plane to the end of the road, turned around, and gave it full throttle. Buck and Chaim, listing far to the left, buckled themselves in. Buck prayed. Chaim muttered,
Lunacy, lunacy, no chance, no hope.
With the engine screaming, the plane was suddenly level, though they weren't moving. Buck didn't know how T was doing it, but he used the propulsion and the brake to feather the craft up onto its one good tire. As he released the brake and maneuvered the controls, the Super J teetered crazily as it shot down the road.
At the other end, the pavement had been twisted and tossed up onto its side to form a 4 or 5 foot barrier. As they hurtled straight toward it, Buck knew T had to find the right combination of speed and runway to pull this off. Buck couldn't tear his eyes from the barrier. Chaim sat with his head between his legs, hands clasped behind his head. He moaned, "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God." And Buck had the impression it was a sincere prayer. It seemed there was no way the J would get enough lift to clear the barrier. T seemed to be doing everything he could to keep the plane level, but the imbalance had to be affecting the speed, too. At the last instant, T seemed to abandon balance and put all his efforts into thrust. The jet lifted off the road, then dropped, and the tire chirped on the pavement before lifting yet again. Buck grimaced and held his breath as they swept toward the barrier. T must have adjusted one flap to avoid a direct hit because the plane lurched right and something underneath slammed the barrier. Now they were in no man's land.
"God forgive me,"
Chaim shouted as the jet was tossed back to the left, then dipped and nearly crashed as T pulled out all the stops. The tail seemed to drag and Buck couldn't imagine how it stayed airborne. They headed for a grove of trees, but it was as if T knew he couldn't afford the drag that a turn would require. He seemed to set the jet at the shallowest possible angle to clear the trees and set it at full power. That was their one chance to get airborne, and if successful, the Super J would rocket into the night toward Greece. T would have to worry later about conserving fuel and landing on one tire. Buck sat with fists clenched, eyes shut, grimacing, fully expecting to hit the trees and crash. He was pressed back against his seat, his head feeling the G-forces as the Super J broke into open sky. He allowed his eyes to open, and in his peripheral vision, Chaim remained hunched over, now lamenting in Hebrew. Buck unstrapped, but found himself struggling to step toward the cockpit against the centrifugal force.
"You did it, T!"
"Lost what was left of that bad tire, though," T said. "Think we lost the whole wheel assembly. I thought we were going down."
"Me too. That was some takeoff."
"I've got about 2 hours to decide how to land. I know one-wheel landings can be done, but I'd almost rather pull up the one good wheel and go in belly first. Would this thing take it?"
"Not like a big one would. I'd say we're 50-50 for success either way."
"That's all?" T reached for Buck's hand.
"I'll see you in heaven regardless."
"Don't say that."
"I mean it. If I didn't believe that, I'd have taken my chances with the GC back there."
Buck started when Chaim spoke, and he realized the Israeli was standing right behind him.
"You see, Cameron, I was right. I should not have come. Now we have a 1 in 2 chance of surviving, and you two are just fine, knowing where you're going."
"I wouldn't say I'm fine, Chaim," Buck said. "I'll be leaving a wife and son."
"You've already given up?" T said. "I said we've got a 50-50 chance of landing successfully. Even a crash landing doesn't have to be fatal."
"Thanks for that cheery word," Buck said, turning to head back to his seat.
"Pray for me," T called after him.
"I will," Buck said.
"So will I," Chaim said, and Buck shot him a look. He didn't appear to be kidding.
After Rosenzweig was buckled in, Buck leaned over and clapped him on the knee.
"You don't have to be afraid of death, you know. I mean, dying, yeah, I'm afraid of that, too. Afraid it'll hurt, that I might burn. I hate leaving my family. But you're right. T and I know where we're going."
Chaim looked terrible, worse than Buck had seen him since the night before. He couldn't make it compute. Chaim had seemed almost giddy after escaping the gala. Then he was suicidal after hearing about Yaakov and his family and Stefan, but now he looked grave. So he was human after all. Despite all the talk of suicide, he was afraid to die. Buck knew he had to be as forthright with Chaim as he had ever been. "We may meet God tonight, Chaim," he began, but Rosenzweig immediately made a face and waved him off.
Don't think I wasn't listening all these years, Cameron. There is nothing more you can tell me.
Still you refuse?
I didn't say that. I just said I don't need to be walked through this.
Buck couldn't believe it.
Chaim said that as if he were going to do this on his own.
I do have one question, however, Cameron. I know you don't consider yourself an expert like Dr. Ben-Judah, but what is your best guess about how God feels about motives?
Motives?
Chaim looked frustrated as he wished Buck caught his drift without Chaim having to explain. He looked away, then back at Buck.
I know God is real, he said, as if confessing a crime. There has been too much evidence to deny it. I can't explain away any of the prophecies because they all come true. The evidences for Jesus as Messiah nearly convinced me, and I had never been a Messiah watcher. But if I were to do what you and Zion have been pleading with me to do for so long, I confess it would be with the wrong motive.
Except for the likelihood that they might be dead within a couple of hours, Buck wished Zion was with them right then. He wanted to ask Chaim what his motive was, but he sensed he would lose him if he interrupted. Chaim pressed his lips together and hung his head. When he looked up again, he seemed to fight tears. He shook his head and looked away.
I need to think some more, Cameron.
Chaim, I've pleaded with you before to not run out of time. Clearly I'm on solid footing to say so now. Suddenly Rosenzweig leaned over and grabbed Buck's elbow.
That's the very issue. I'm scared to death. I don't want to die. I thought I did, thought it was the only answer to being a murderer, even if I believed I was just in killing the man. But I did it with forethought, with months of forethought. I planned it, fashioned my own weapon, and saw it through. I have no pity, no sympathy for Nikolai Carpathia. I came to believe, as you do, that he was the devil incarnate.
That wasn't quite accurate, but Buck held his tongue. While believers were convinced Carpathia was the Antichrist and deserved to be killed and stay dead, they knew that he wouldn't literally be Satan incarnate until he came back to life. Whether he deserved to live again or not, that was what was prophesied.
It's hard for me to fathom that I might have been in God's plan from the beginning. If it is true that Carpathia is the enemy of God, and that he was supposed to die from a sword wound to the head, I feel like Judas.
Judas? A non-religious Jew knows the New Testament too?
Don't look surprised, Cameron. Everyone understands what a Judas is. Someone was to betray Jesus, and it fell to Judas. Someone was to murder Antichrist, and while I cannot say it actually fell to me, I took the job into my own hands. But say it was my destiny. Though apparently God wanted it done, it certainly was not legal. And look at what it has cost me already. My freedom. My peace of mind, which I admit is only a distant memory. My loved ones. But Cameron, can God accept me if my motive is selfish?
Buck squinted and turned to look out the window. The dim, sparse lights of Israel receded fast.
We all come to faith selfish in some ways, Chaim. But could it be otherwise? We want to be forgiven. We want to be accepted, received, included. We want to go to heaven instead of hell. We want to be able to face death knowing what comes next. I was selfish. I didn't want to face the Antichrist without the protection of God in my life. But Cameron, I am merely afraid to die. I feel like a coward. Here I did this rash thing which many would say took courage and even strength of character,
At first I took pride in it. Now I know, of course, that God could have used anyone to do it. He could have caused something to pierce Carpathia's head during the earthquake. He could have had a political rival or a crazy man do it. Perhaps he did. Part of it was compulsion, especially perfecting the weapon. But I had motives, Cameron. I hated the man. I hated his lies and his broken promises to my homeland. I hated even what he did to the practicing Jews and their new temple, even though I did not count myself among them. I am without excuse. I am guilty. I am a sinner. I am lost. I don't want to die. I don't want to go to hell. But I fear he will cast me out because I squandered so many opportunities, because I resisted for so long, because I suffered even many of the judgments and still was cold and hard. Now, if I come whimpering to God as a child, will he see through me? Will he consider me the little boy who cried wolf? Will he know that down deep I am merely a man who once had a wonderful life and enjoyed what I now see were bountiful gifts from God? A creative mind, a wonderful home and family, precious friends, and became a crazy old fool? Cameron, I sit here knowing that all you and Zion and your dear associates have told me is true. I believe that God loves me and cares about me and wants to forgive me and accept me, and yet my own conscience gets in the way. Buck was praying as he hadn't prayed in ages. Chaim, if you told God what you're telling me, you'd find out the depth of his mercy. But Cameron, I would be doing this only because I'm afraid I'm going to die in this plane, that's all. Do you understand? Buck nodded. He understood, but did he know the answer to Chaim's question? People through the ages had all kinds of motives for becoming believers, and surely fear was a common one. He had heard Bruce Barnes say that people sometimes come to Christ for fire insurance, to stay out of hell, only to later realize all the benefits that come with the policy. You said yourself that I don't consider myself an expert, Buck said, but you also said that you knew you were a sinner. That's the real reason we need Jesus. If you weren't a sinner, you'd be perfect, and you wouldn't need to worry about forgiveness and salvation. But I knew I was a sinner before, and I didn't care. You weren't staring death in the face, either. You weren't wondering whether you might end up in hell. Rosenzweig rubbed his palms together. I was tempted to do this when I was suffering from the locust attack. I knew that was a prophesied biblical event, but I also knew that becoming a believer would not speed my recovery. You told me that yourself. And relief would have been my only motive then, as I fear it is now. What I should do intellectually is wait and see if I survive this landing or this crash or whatever it is we're going to do. If I am not facing imminent death, I won't be so suspicious of my own intentions. In other words, Buck said, get me out of this and I'll become a believer. Chaim shook his head. I know better than to bargain with God. He owes me nothing. He need not do one more thing to persuade me. I just want to be honest. If I would not have come to the same conclusion on the ground or in a plane with two good tires, then I should not rush into it now. Buck cocked his head. Friend, rushing into this would be the last way I would describe you. My question is, why do you feel in any more danger now than you did on the ground, or than you will feel if we land safely? Chaim raised his chin and shut his eyes. I don't.
The GC has already announced my death and is now free to exterminate me without the nuisance of publicity. That's why I found myself running to this plane. I don't need to tell you the dread of living in exile. But whatever motive you have now, you will also have if we survive. Nothing changes.
Maybe I'll lose the urgency, Rosenzweig said. The sense of imminence.
But you don't know that.
They may have to foam the runway, bring out the emergency vehicles, all that.
You can't hide under a blanket or claim to be contagious when we leave the plane, and you can't hide in the lav until the coast is clear. You're going to be as exposed and as vulnerable as ever, safe landing or no.
Chaim held up a hand and slowly closed his eyes.
Give me a minute, he said. I may have more questions, but just leave me alone a moment.
That was the last thing Buck wanted to do just then, but neither did he want to push Chaim away. He settled back, amazed at how smooth was the ride that might lead them to eternity.
Kenny Bruce took long afternoon naps, and Zion looked forward to that. He loved the boy and had had a lot of fun with him for the last 14 months, even in cramped quarters. He was a good-natured, though normal kid, and Zion loved teasing him and playing with him. Kenny could be wearying, however, especially for one who hadn't been around infants for nearly 20 years. Zion needed a nap himself, though he was still desperate not to miss whatever was going to happen in New Babylon.
Mama?
Kenny asked for the 12th time, not troubled, but curious. It was unusual for her to be gone.
Bye-bye, Zion said. Home soon. Getting sleepy?
Kenny shook his head, even as he rubbed his eyes and appeared to be trying to keep them open. He yawned and sat with a toy, soon losing interest. He lay on his back, feet flat on the floor, knees up. Staring at the ceiling, he yawned, turned on his side, and was soon motionless. Zion carried him to the playpen so he wouldn't fuss if he awoke before Zion did. There were plenty of things to keep him occupied there. Zion settled before the TV again and put his feet up. The underground was cool, so he draped